Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for being here tonight. I do hope that the first two sessions have been helpful to you. The title for this evening's topic is From Role Rigidity to Gender Fluidity, which is an attempt to try to grapple with some of the historical and cultural context of where we are right now, dealing with some of the gender issues, but also to do that in the light of theology of the body. In some ways, you could say that John Paul II's theology of the body was quite prophetic because it anticipated things that were coming that I think when he was writing it, none of us could actually imagine happening in terms of certain developments that we've seen. But in I think some profound ways, I think he did see the writing on the wall and saw where things were going. I've actually come across some amazing statements that he made back in the 80s and 90s, for example, about the importance of accepting our masculinity and femininity as part of an integral part of our identity as sons and daughters of God. So he clearly could see things as they were, sort of like the trajectory of certain conversations that were going on in the academy, which now has become mainstream in our culture. So we're going to try to dip into some of that tonight. I want to talk about just some of the foundational roots of what I would call the gender identity crisis that we're living through right now, as well as some of the issues around branding and self-invention, which I think is part of what's going on in our world today. And so what I'm going to do is apply certain principles of theology of the body and use those principles to shed a light on current cultural realities. But I want to do this with a very big caveat, which is that we're trying to tackle a pretty tricky historical problem that's complex, and which you could do an entire course on. So I can only touch on certain, I think, key points that I hope are informative and enlightening and helpful, but certainly not exhaustive by any stretch of the imagination. Picking up from there, I want to tie original shame to the problem of personal identity. Okay, so that's going to be the first move I make. And then from there, I want to talk about the truth of our identity. How do we as Christians ground our identities as human beings? Where do we find the truth about who we are? And then from there, we're going to talk about looking at our culture, the problem of how we brand ourselves and how we invent ourselves in this postmodern context that we live in. And I'll kind of define each of those terms, branding, self-invention, and postmodern, so that can make some sense. And then as we wrap up, we're going to look at the relationship between human nature and cultural conventions around the roles that men and women have played in our society and how there's been a massive revolt against that. And then we'll conclude with looking at how theology of the body really provides the right solution to what is admittedly a real crisis for people. Their gender identity, the wounds of that are very real for people. And what we're going to see is that the world's answer to that problem is actually making the problem worse, whereas I think theology of the body provides really the answer and the solution to the real crisis that people really experience around their identities, especially their sexual identities, their psychosexual identities. Okay, so that's a lot of ground to cover, but that's the path we're gonna take. So let's begin looking at original shame and the problem of personal identity. When you go back into Genesis 3, after Adam and Eve, we're told that Adam and Eve commit this sin. It tells us that they hid from the Lord. They covered themselves. They made coverings, and then they hid. Okay, so Genesis 3, 7 to 8 says, "Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and that man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden." So there's two things that are very striking in this passage. One is that the shame they experience, that is, the realization that they're naked, and if you remember from what we said last time, the realization of their nakedness is the recognition of their vulnerability, because now they're being subject to a look which is not a look of gratitude and appreciation and affirmation, but a look of lust, a look of objectification and reduction. So the shame causes them to cover themselves. So we would say that's a defense mechanism. That's the language we would use. We're protecting ourselves. So we protect our outer selves in order actually to protect our inner self. Okay, we have an innate sense of our own value, and we don't want people to look at us and view us in a certain way. That is, when we are operating out of our healthiest self, that's the case. Of course, when we're deeply wounded in this area, we can objectify ourselves, and we can project ourselves as sexual objects into the world because that's what we believe is the basis of our value. But that's just a deeper crisis of the person. And then the other thing is they hide for fear of judgment. They fear the Lord's judgment upon them. But I think we can also relate this to the fact that not only can we, in our shame, fear God's judgment. That is, we fear that God no longer loves us, that God no longer values and treasures us, but we also can fear the judgment of other people. So we can sort of be exiled. We can experience a kind of exile, right? We're cast out, or we are separated from a sense of connection and intimacy with God and with each other, and therefore we cover ourselves and we hide. So this is very figurative language, very primitive, but yet significant language that speaks about an experience that we continue to have. Okay? That is an experience of shame, which leads us to protect ourselves and fear the judgments of other people. Okay? And in the process of this experience, we can develop a really deep sense of self-loathing and self-contempt towards our own sense of self, our dignity, our value. Okay, so this is described by John Paul II really as a universal experience, and particularly between man and woman. I mean, even between men or between women, it's oftentimes in competition for the opposite sex. So if I feel, for example, insecure in the presence of another male, it's because I think he is of greater, you know, he's more attractive or he's more masculine or more something than I am, or vice versa. So this is a common universal experience. So what comes with this experience is a lost sense of our dignity that leads to a lost sense of our deepest identity. When we don't feel that we're lovable, when we feel that people are constantly scrutinizing and judging us, the reality is we kind of lose sight of who we are. We begin to live our life out of a lot of lies that we come to believe about ourselves, which expresses a kind of self-loathing. And the reality is the experience and the phenomenon of personal sin usually grows out of this experience, because we turn to sinful behaviors as a way of coping with the suffering and the pain of that lost sense of our dignity. And so we just exacerbate the problem for ourselves, actually, because that just creates more a cycle of shame and self-loathing and self-contempt. You know, I remember when I was growing up in the 80s, I kind of was in my teen years in the 80s, and there was a lot of good popular psychology out there that was all about self-esteem and self-affirmation. And I can remember, you know, you're supposed to write affirmations about yourself on a sticky note, put it on your mirror, you know. I remember there was a poem called The Man in the Mirror, and it was all about how, you know, it doesn't matter what anybody thinks about you. What matters is what the person looking back at you from the mirror is saying about you. And I remember I tried to live that psychology very earnestly for a lot of years, and I discovered that it didn't work. It didn't work partly because I wasn't living a very good life at that time, and therefore I couldn't pretend like I loved myself when I was doing things that I didn't like I was doing, but I kept doing them. But at the same time, I also realized that I needed to feel and experience the love of another in order to have a sense of my dignity and my value. Okay, so we're going to unpack that, because that's a very important reality of our nature as persons called to the communion of love. It's actually kind of a lie of our modern culture that we can purely kind of ex nihilo, out of nothing, affirm ourselves. We come to know our value and our dignity in the experience of being loved, first and foremost by God, but secondarily through all the people that God puts in our life. And that's very critical. My sense of esteem, self-esteem, my sense of dignity comes from knowing myself as loved by another person. And I think there's a world out there that wants to say that can't be true. So I have to I have to assert myself. I have to prop myself up. I have to affirm myself in order to have a sense of my own value, my own dignity. And I think what we're discovering is that philosophy is not working. It hasn't been working for a long time. So people just keep getting more anxious and more depressed, and they keep trying to find more creative ways of escaping their realities. So here's the truth of our identity. The deepest truth, the deepest mystery that we know in and through Christ is that we are beloved sons and daughters of a loving Father. That's the most fundamental truth. Now, that's challenging because we have to deal with being a son or a daughter. Okay? And a lot of us in the world today are really struggling with being a girl or a boy. And there's lots of reasons for that. And they're not reasons that are trivial. To put it mildly, when we grow up in this world, we're generally not very nice to each other when it comes to our boyness and our girlness. So we suffer a lot of wounds in that. And then we have to believe we're also sons and daughters of a loving Father. And of course, in a world that is beset by a crisis of masculinity and fatherhood, that's very hard for people to believe, but it's absolutely necessary for them to believe. There's a lot of research about how important fathers are. Obviously, mothers are very important. They're equally as important. But in the absence of healthy men, male role models, and fathers in our culture today, we're experiencing a particular kind of crisis that can't be explained except in relationship to what's missing in our situation today for so many people. So we have to be honest about that. So our deepest identity is that we are beloved sons and daughters of a loving Father, and we are loved not because of what we do, much less not for what we look like, but we are loved into existence because God found pleasure in creating us, and he delights and rejoices in our existence. And if I were to say, well, what's the fundamental crisis today that's going on, is most people don't believe that. They don't know that. They don't experience that in their lives. And as a consequence of that, because being a son or a daughter of a loving Father is so foundational, obviously we believe we have a loving mother in the Blessed Mother and in Holy Mother Church. But again, given the crises that's been going on in the church, that's difficult. People don't always find the church a loving mother. So to break through in our lives to an experience of the Father's love and our mother, our Blessed Mother's love, and to see ourselves as beloved sons and daughters, that is very, very challenging today, even if you're in the church. So you can imagine what that would be like for someone who has never been raised in the faith or doesn't really know anything about Jesus or the Holy Trinity or any of that. Okay, so there's a long road to travel to help people come to that deepest sense of their identity. So just to unpack this a little bit more, right? We said that we bear the image of the Trinity. And what that means is as human persons, we are by nature relational beings. We are not individual atoms that choose to enter into relationships with people. We are by nature persons that are born into relationships. And those relationships are either healthy or they're dysfunctional. But, you know, like I don't get to choose the family I'm born into, but I am by nature someone's son or daughter. Well, obviously I'm a son, but as images of God, we are persons. And as persons, we are by nature relational beings. And therefore our identity is rooted in relationships. So this goes back to our Trinitarian theology, because we would say, well, you can't understand the Father except in relation to the Son. And you can't understand the Son except in relation to the Father, because the Father is the Father of the Son, and the Son is the Son of the Father. And the Holy Spirit is the love between the Father and the Son. So you can't really understand the Spirit except by understanding the relationship between the Father and the Son. So you can't segregate the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit away from each other as these little, like, they're not parts of God. They're not, you know, they're not little modes of the Godhead. They're relations. And they're relations of love. And so if we're born, if we're created in the image of this God, then we are relations, we are created to be relations of love. That's our deepest reality. And so when those relationships are broken and wounded, it's not a surprise that we devolve into structural crisis. We can't not have that experience of woundedness and fragmentation and disintegration when the most crucial relationships in our life are broken. And to further that, our relationality, to come back to theology of the body, is that we are persons created with either a male or a female sex. So we're either masculine or feminine persons. which is very tied up with our bodies. So if we experience alienation from our bodies because of how people have treated us, you know, I might speak about this a little more, but for now I'll just say this. Like when I was growing up as a kid, I had a great family. I had tons of love in my family. I mean, there's literally nothing I could complain about. I had amazing parents and amazing siblings, and I still experienced a tremendous crisis in my teenage years because of how I was treated in school. And I remember, and I'll elaborate maybe a little bit more later about why this story was significant, but I remember one time when I got dressed up for a dance, and I was probably a sophomore, junior, it was that awkward stage, and I was a late bloomer, but I came into the living room and my mom was there, and she looked at me and she says, "Wow, you look so handsome." I've never forgotten that experience because it was a total turning point in my life. Because my mother was acknowledging and recognizing my masculinity as her son. She was calling me a man. And I needed my mother at that time of my life to say that to me. Because, of course, none of the girls in my class were. That makes sense. I needed that affirmation of that I am a embodied male who was very small and very young looking for his age. Still hadn't really gone through puberty, but she was acknowledging and affirming my masculinity. That identity that emerges in our life is dependent upon the health of the relationships that we experience in this life, for good or for ill. So we can experience a tremendous crisis in our identity as males and females if somewhere along the road we're mistreated or abused. And of course, it's by degree. If we're really abused, you can imagine how deep that damage can be. And you can imagine the levels of shame and self-alienation that people can feel if they've been really taken advantage of, physically, sexually, whatever. And that can happen in all sorts of ways. That can happen in the family. It can happen on the playground. It can happen at a school dance. It can happen in any number of ways. Things that embed themselves in our psychosexual consciousness that can really damage us. So we have to be very attentive about the familial and the social contexts within which we live, okay? Whether it's the family, our schools, the different tribes we might be part of, whether it could be a team or a club we belong to. We also have identities that are rooted in our ethnicity, our national identities, our cultural identities. All of these contexts that we come of age in and through, they all shape the sense of who we are. And so to the degree to which those contexts are positive and affirming of our fundamental dignity is the degree to which we grow in a sense of who we are and our identity. And the degree to which those things are broken down and are wounding us, it leads to our disintegration and our fragmentation and ultimately to a crisis of who we are. Okay, so within the context of what I've just said, we live in an age in which we're dealing with a crisis in what I would call gender socialization. So let's move on here to talking about what I call the problem of branding and self-invention in the postmodern context. One of the ways that we can divide history is at the dawn of human history, in the beginning, and I think John Paul II really is, this is what he's describing, is that human beings become conscious beings, and therefore we become Homo sapien, the wise ones, the wise man. How that happened in real history, you know, nobody really knows. None of us were there. But Genesis makes it really clear that we come into consciousness. And there's a lot of things you can say about consciousness. We become, in that moment, and this happens for every child, when you grow up, like, you become conscious. And when you become conscious, you become self-determining, self-directing, and you start having ideas about things and agendas. You know, it's, when a seven-year-old hits the age of reason, they start scheming and plotting and planning and manipulating and playing games and so there's this awakening of consciousness. We can become reflective creatures. But what happened in the modern period, around 1400, 1450 on, is we became a self-conscious race. That is, we, in our philosophical discoveries, we became conscious of our consciousness. So we became self-reflecting in Western civilization and began to reflect on the nature of consciousness and the nature of subjectivity and the nature of identity and the nature of, like, how do we know that we know, you know, questions like this. How do we know that we know? that represented a fundamental shift in world history. And it made us very navel-gazing, to be honest with you. It made us very navel-gazing. Now, being self-conscious creatures in and of itself isn't bad until you combine that with all of the consequences of sin. And now what happens is we enter in the 20th century, we come into a postmodern moment. And very simply, what we mean by that is that modernity became hyper-intentional. So from about 1450 to about 1950, that window of time, civilization became hyper-intentional and we studied everything. We tried to discover the laws of everything. And we tried to conform our lives to these models and frameworks of existence that we created for ourselves. We had one for the state. We had one for the economy. We had one for the church. We had one for the family. We created these very rigid social structures. And everybody was expected to be conformed to them. And if they didn't, we punished them very severely. The modes of punishment and shaming in those centuries, if you've ever studied it, it's unbelievable what we did to people. Like, we hear about tarring and feathering people, like we really did that. So we tried to discipline sin and social disorder out of people in very brutal and very authoritarian ways. We militarized, you could say, social relationships. We leaned into very severe forms of capital punishment, corporal punishment. And then we put out in front of people these very idealized forms of social life and social existence. And as we moved into the 19th and 20th century, as we become increasingly intentional and technocratic in our way of dealing with things, you know, we get the printing press and the newspaper, and then we start into television and radio and marketing, and now the digital age and social media. It's like this progression of social engineering and social conditioning. So what represents the postmodern moment is when we begin to see a breakdown in the system and a wholesale revolt against it, and we begin to deconstruct all of these rigid social forms. You know, welcome to 1968. Like, by the time you get into the 60s and the 50s already, everything was starting to fall apart. It was like pushing a beach ball under the water. You know, you can only suppress certain things for so long before your hand's going to slip off the ball and it's all just going to fly up and hit you in the face. So in the 1950s, everything is so picture perfect, especially, you know, in America and in Western civilizations, Western societies, Northern Hemisphere, Western societies. You know, it's all over the magazines, it's all over the TV. Everything is so idealized. Everything is so perfect. But the reality is that underneath all of that, none of that was really going on. People weren't really experiencing those ideal forms in their homes, in their schools. And I just want to throw another piece in this. You know, we went through two world wars, and the men that were raising those families, many of them were the men that came home. Who survived? Who came home? And guess what? Guess they're called the silent generation for a reason, because they simply could not and did not talk about their experiences in the wars. So the 1960s and the sexual revolution, and we'll get into this more next time, this is the postmodern moment. This is where the entire edifice is torn down, because we can't deal with the lack of integrity and the lack of contradiction between the public face of propriety that we were projecting into the world and the interior reality of people's social experiences and their interior experiences. And it's no accident that modern psychology comes into the fore at this time, because there's a lot of theoreticians, a lot of scientists that are trying to understand the psychological realities that people are experiencing. And there's all sorts of movements going on in culture that are undermining the modern project. Expressivism in art, the rise of pornography, you know, think of Hugh Hefner and Playboy magazine. You can think about romanticism and the hippie movement, emotivism, you know, and if it feels good, do it. All of this is a kind of tearing down, pulling apart of the modern edifice of a kind of legalistic, authoritarian, rigid models of social relationality. The sad thing is what was lost in the modern period was a true sense of the self and the dignity. We lost the Christian notion of personhood. But what happened in the postmodern moment is we completely buried it. So the solution was, as proven, to be worse than the problem we were trying to eradicate. Instead of returning to the anthropological roots of our Christian understanding of civilization, we rejected Christianity. We threw the baby out with the bathwater, we could say. Here's the good news, is that we are redeemed in Christ, okay, in both our bodily and in our relational dimensions. So you got to think about, well, as a man, how did Jesus treat women? That's very important. And think about the women in the Bible and how they love Jesus. Okay, the foundational relationship, there was a maternal relationship. There was also sisters, sister wives, they're called actually. And it's within the context of those very natural human relationships that Jesus is expressing his bridegroomness in relationship to his bride. That's the fundamental relationship. We're going to unpack that piece more next time. So stay tuned. But the good news is that Jesus has redeemed both our bodiliness. He affirms the goodness of the human body, both in its masculinity and its femininity. Because in Christ, there's neither male nor female, meaning there can be no discrimination between the two. There's neither Jew nor Greek, right? He, in a sense, abolishes all prejudice in himself. And he opens up a space where all people, in all of their differences, in all their distinctiveness, can find unity and love and communion. So that's why we say Jesus is the kingdom of heaven. He is the kingdom. Because he has established an entirely different political order of relationality in and through the mystery of the body and its masculinity and its femininity. Go to Ephesians chapter 5. Paul gets it. How men and women, husbands and wives, are to love each other. Paul learned that from Jesus. So, continuing on now with the problem of branding and self-invention in the modern context, we got the branding, I think, is an easy concept. Like, we like to brand ourselves, right? We like to identify with external things. Part of this is just human nature. But it's also the case, okay, it's also the case that when I say it's human nature, it's like we like to associate with social groups. Every time I go home to Ohio, to where my wife's from, I have to make a calculated choice as to whether I'm wearing black and gold or I'm wearing silver and red. Or, you know, everybody has their Rushi Raider baseball cap on because the Rushi Raiders are like, you know, the hometown school team. You know, we do brand ourselves with our tribal identities, and that's normal and that's healthy. We like to wave the American flag at this time because we're proud to be Americans. You know, that's we celebrate the 4th of July. There's something good and holy and healthy in that. The problem is that we can be too reductive and we can reduce our value to our brand identities. And one of the ironies of the times we live in is that young people, especially, they fall over themselves to identify themselves as a unique person who's just like all the other people they hang out with. Do you ever notice the irony of that? So, you know, I'm going to be alternative like all the other alternative people I'm hanging out with, and we all kind of end up looking the same. Well, that's because they haven't quite figured out their human nature. That's normal to identify that way. But the reality is that the one to whom we most fundamentally belong is God. And that's the root of our identity. So we can turn our brand identities into idols. So there's a lot of that going on in our culture today. And a lot of people will just identify themselves in a certain way because they're just trying to make a statement to get attention. You know, when you dig down and scrape under the surface, it's not all that deep. They're just a person in crisis looking for someone to affirm them and see them and hear them. You know, so you see this like a teenage, you know, I think of some friends of ours, you know, their teenage daughter came home and her hair is all colored. I remember when I was in high school, I grew my hair out really long, and I'll never forget, my dad said, you know, my mom was having a real problem with it. She was very worried, you know, like, what's happening to my son? But my dad was kind of chill about it, and he's like, you know, Michael, I don't really care about your hair. I just love the kid under it. That was all he ever said about my hair, and I eventually got over it. But, you know, I wanted to stand out. But when you scratch under the surface of that, there wasn't a whole lot to it except for just an insecure teenage boy who was looking for affirmation. And I was identifying with a particular genre of music, so that's the way I went. Unfortunately, we make such a big deal out of this today. Okay, so that's brand identity. And then self-invention, of course, is like, you know, we just keep taking this more and more further and further, that the idea that people can invent themselves. Now, clearly, there is room for people to express their uniqueness, their own preferences. You know, I want to wear my hair this way, or I want to wear, I grew a goatee out recently, you know. Like, there's ways in which the human body is capable of uniquely expressing who we are. And again, that's a good and beautiful thing. And God made us that way so we could do that. So we should be respectful of those differences in one another and not mock and make fun of that. But yet, again, at the same time, we can only go so far with how much we can invent ourselves. Because at the end of the day, our identity is fundamentally rooted in the one to whom we belong, which is God. And so there's always that existential restlessness that can't be resolved until the soul can rest in the Lord's love and know that they're loved and know that they're loved beyond any fashion statement, beyond any type of music, any performance they can achieve. Let me just sum up a couple of points and then I have to head into a wrap up here. We're dealing today with what I like to call the tyranny of ideal forms. The tyranny of ideal forms. And those two things, especially for young people, revolve around external appearance or beauty, looks, and performance. So long before a child ever has any opportunity to invent themselves or create their identity, they are being told whether that they are either affirmed for their looks and their performance, or they're being criticized and put down and shamed. And generally what happens is people who want to change their genders or change their dress and dress like the opposite sex, these are people that are experiencing on some level a crisis in their identity about their masculinity or their femininity. And in one way or another, they believe they're going to find the affirmation and the love and the embrace that they need by doing what they're doing. Psychologically, that's a very complicated situation, and there's a lot of factors in there that we can't get into. But put simply, that's what happens. As I head into a conclusion, I want to end in about 5 minutes here, but I want to talk about the relationship between what I call nature and convention. What exactly does biology determine for us socially? This is very important because this is what gets us from the role rigidity to the gender fluidity piece. So when we consider what nature defines for us in terms of roles, social roles, we realize that it's not a whole lot. Nature determines whether we are a mother or a father, a brother or a sister, a son or daughter, an aunt or an uncle, a grandma or a grandpa. Okay, you see where I'm going here? So what's most fundamental to our human existence is that we exist in these relationships with those we call family. But I'm also someone's neighbor. I'm someone's teammate. I'm someone's classmate. And I experience those different roles in and through my body, my gender, male or female, my biological sex, you could say, which is not just biological, but it's also psychological. But on the other side of the equation is what we would call a matter of convention. So when we talk about, John Paul II talks about the feminine genius. Maybe you've heard this term, the feminine genius, but we can talk about the masculine and the feminine genius. In other words, there are certain inclinations, aptitudes, and proclivities that are proper to men and women. But when you try to pin it down to specific social roles, it gets a little difficult because you end up falling into caricatures and stereotypes. So what you can say sociologically is you can say, well, in general, because of the feminine genius, these kinds of roles will generally be occupied mostly by women. And these kind of roles will be generally occupied by men, but there's always exceptions. I don't know if you remember the Berenstain Bears book from the 1970s that's titled He Can, She Can. Right? The whole premise of that book is to try to demonstrate that girls can do what boys do. And the funny thing about it is that I remember growing up as a kid hearing, remember when the female soccer league started up in Seattle, it was like, I can remember hearing people say, men, well, girls don't play soccer, but they do. They just play soccer as girls play soccer and boys play soccer as boys play soccer, but it's the same game. Okay, there's a distinction. It's not exactly the same. The physicality and the psychology of men and women is different. They're going to compete differently. One of the things that happened in our society is we became too rigid in our roles. That's the part about role rigidity. We became too rigid in this is what the perfect woman looks like. This is how the perfect woman acts. This is how the perfect man looks. This is how the perfect man acts and dresses and so on. Okay? So what's a matter of convention? Well, how we dress, jobs, pastimes. Again, there's we can see certain general trends. Like, for example, in nursing, most nursing jobs are going to be held by women. Most firefighters are going to be men. But there's exceptions to that rule because we have to deal with, for example, what do you do with the effeminate male or the competitive female? The boy who wants to dance and the girl that wants to get out on the football field and tackle the boys. See, in the age of role rigidity and the tyranny of ideal forms, 1930s, 40s, 50s, in this time period, what we did with effeminate males is we told them they were gay. We made fun of them. We mocked them. And we used pejorative and derogatory terms to describe them. We did the same thing with females. Oh, you're a butch. That was the term. And so I think we socialized people into these rigid roles, and we didn't create enough space for the legitimate expressions that masculinity and femininity are actually allowed. Okay. So what ended up happening is instead of trying to loosen the conventions, create a little bit more latitude, we were doing some of that, but we didn't do it soon enough and fast enough. The solution became gender fluidity. So if I want to dress more like a girl, then I must be a girl. If I'm a girl and want to play boy sports, I must be a boy. And there's actually interesting research on the developmental process of particularly the competitive female in that book, Taking Sex Differences Seriously. So we have to be very careful when we look at what nature provides, which is those relational, men can't be mothers, women cannot be fathers. But that isn't to say that men can't have feminine qualities and women can't have masculine qualities. It's not that black and white. In terms of wrapping up here, theology of the body and gender ideology, the solution to the problem of the gender identity crisis, the problem of the psycho-spiritual identity, is to go back to the logic of the gift, our Christian understanding of the dignity of the body, and the sincere gift of self. We have to inculcate these values into our socialization of people, first in the home, but also in our other social environments. So you hear a lot, and I think there's, you know, the laudable efforts around, for example, the bullying, you know, trying to stop bullying, but I think we have to go much deeper than that. I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to force ourselves to accept things which are disordered, trying to normalize those things. We're trying to normalize the woundedness rather than find true pathways to healing, which is going to be found in cultivating real relationships of love and interpersonal communion.